Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 18th of August. Our guest this hour is Robert Compton, and Robert has had several careers over the past 30 years. He is currently a filmmaker, and he has created, produced, and financed the documentary 2 Million Minutes. After eighth grade, the clock starts ticking, and young people have 2 Million Minutes until high school graduation. And during that time, they turn from teens to adults. Americans are not globally aware. Americans are losing their competitive edge. And this film compares and contrasts the high school education experiences of students in India, China, and the United States. It takes viewers into the classrooms, into the homes of these students, and it finds out that how students spend their 2 million minutes in class, at home studying, playing sports, working, sleeping, socializing, or just having fun will definitely have an impact on their economic prospects for the rest of their lives. Bob Compton has had several careers over the past 30 years, IBM systems engineer, professional venture capitalist, an investor, an entrepreneur, and a filmmaker, and he has just returned from the Olympics, I understand. So we'll start with that before we move into the film, if he doesn't mind. Well, welcome, phone calls. I know you're keenly interested in education, and you'll have a lot to say about this particular topic. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Joining us in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050. And if you would like to send an email, you can do that at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, Robert Compton. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Just back from the Olympics, sir.
Yes, ma'am. Landed late last night.
Oh, my gosh. How can you even talk?
A little bit tired, but I've had a few cups of coffee. So
yeah, that's good. How was it? What did you see?
Oh, it was spectacular. We saw Michael Phelps win we saw him win 7 of the 8 gold medals.
Oh my!
And particularly the butterfly, where he finished won by a hundredth of a second, which was spectacular.
Right.
And then we saw a lot of. I have two teenage daughters, and I took them to a lot of events that you don't normally see on TV. We saw cycling, we saw ping pong, we saw women's judo, women's fencing. And so it was a really terrific experience for all of us.
I would imagine so. I'm envious. I particularly enjoyed watching the swimming. So this film, tell me if this is a true story. The film came about because you were in India and you were having conversations about education and what young people were learning, and then you started looking at schools?
Yes. This was back in 2005, and I had, at that time, about 100 software developers with several of my companies over in India, and I went over to visit them with the CEO of one of my companies, and we took them out to dinner. And to be candid, I expected it to be kind of a boring dinner and hopefully a short one. and as it turned out, we had them in tables around the room, and I just kind of went from table to table and chatted with them, and it was just an extraordinarily interesting evening. All of these programmers, there were roughly 50% men, 50% women, between ages of 25 and 35. They obviously were very smart in math and science, but I was really amazed at how globally aware they were, how knowledgeable they were in U.S. and European history, Western literature. They were really what I would call very well-rounded, knowledgeable, articulate adults. Mm-hmm. And it was so different from my perception of what they would be that I got interested in how they attained that knowledge. And so I started visiting their schools. And, mm-hmm. I started with their colleges, which they all went to, top universities, and which weren't that different than the U.S., just with less, I would say, with less socializing and less alcohol. But then I went into their high schools and middle schools and elementary schools, and there were really two seminal moments, Kathleen. One was I was in a first grade class in Bangalore with 5 and 6 year old Indian boys and girls, And I asked their teacher if I could ask them all one question. And the question was, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I went from child to child with my little digital camera. And I said, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? And the answer was engineer, scientist, cardiologist, astronomer, fighter pilot, engineer, teacher, engineer. And I had a just an incredible misperception of India going over there that, you know, I knew there were some smart people, but I didn't, I kind of thought of it as a fairly impoverished, and it is,
right.
You know, I mean, they still have 600 million people living at the poverty level. But they, these kids had just extraordinarily high career ambitions. And so then I asked if I could visit with some teenage girls who were the same age as my daughters, and at that time in middle school and freshman in high school. And what I discovered was that the curriculum they were taking and the effort they were putting in into education, my daughters, who are straight-A students, you know, enjoy academics, go to a very expensive private school, my daughters were 2 to 3 years behind the Indian girls in math, chemistry, physics.
2 to 3 years?
Yes.
Isn't that something?
Physics, biology, and computer science. And the reason is they start, well, they're two national curricula over there, and both are higher standard than any of the state curricula that we have here in the States. And they, you know, they start chemistry, physics, and biology in seventh grade. And so by 10th grade, you know, they've already taken physics for 4 years, chemistry for 4 years, biology for 4 years. Well, my daughter, who's going to be a junior this year, is going to take biology for her first time. Because in America, you only take 1 year of biology, 1 year of physics, 1 year of chemistry. And so, yeah, you know, if you take biology for 4 years before my daughter takes any, you are by definition at least 4 years ahead of my daughter.
Right.
And so I came back, and my wife and I completely changed how we educate our daughters. I mean, they're still in private school, but we realized that to be globally competitive, our daughters needed a lot of supplemental education to remain competitive with their Indian peers. And then later I went and visited Chinese schools and found the same thing. And so I was, as I talked with my friends about this, what I realized was Americans, and not just the average Americans, but even when I screened my film at the Harvard Graduate School of Education to the faculty, there were 100 faculty members there. I just asked the question of the audience, you know, how many of you have studied the curricula in India and China? And the answer was zero. And so the level of ignorance of what was going on in the two most populous, fastest-growing countries in the world, I thought was, one, astonishing, and two, I thought was not good for America. I mean, we need to know, for our children to be competitive in the global economy, we need to know what the best and the brightest are doing around the world. And we were ignoring, as a country, both India and China, and focusing the educational establishment in America focuses on the PISA scores and the TIMSS scores, which focus on only the developed countries. And because India and China are not considered developed countries up until today, they've not participated in either of those exams. So, and I had seen this in my companies. I'm an investor in several dozen high technology businesses, and more of my businesses were moving not the call center work over to India and China, or India that you hear about, and not just the low skill manufacturing to China, but they were moving more and more of their R&D. They're very sophisticated work over there because they could find large quantities of highly educated engineers and scientists that they couldn't find here in America. And it's not just my company. I mean, Microsoft, Google, Yahoo, Hewlett Packard. You go to Electronics City in Bangalore, and you drive down the road, and it, you know, you think you're in Silicon Valley. I mean, mm-hmm. every company is American, and they have anywhere from, I think Google has 5,000 engineers.
Goodness.
In India. Hewlett-Packard has 20,000. And, I just got back from China. I had lunch with a woman who is a engineer at Oracle. They have 1,000 engineers there in Beijing. So it was very worrisome for me, for my daughter's ability to compete in the 21st century. And I think it has profound implications for our, you know, for my daughter's generation, for our children who are in their teens or mm-hmm. earlier. They are going to face a level of competition that I'm 52. I never had to face. You know, when I was growing up, China was, you know, destroying its population under Mao. Mm-hmm. You know, in the Cultural Revolution, and India had. Initially under the leadership of Gandhi, had decided to become entirely self-sufficient and inwardly focused, so they didn't compete. And now our children are going to face 2.4 billion competitors that they never faced before, who are highly educated and highly motivated.
Right.
And I think that has profound implications for our economy and really frightening implications for our children.
I'm sure it does. How much of it is fueled? You mentioned poverty and that there is a lot of poverty still in both of these countries, in India and China. The film makes reference to this is a ticket out of poverty. Can you talk about that and talk about it also in terms of the United States until fairly recently being pretty fat and sassy and happy and so yeah. not having to move yourself to a better level because you already had it pretty good?
Yeah, I think well, my parents' generation, my parents were teenagers during the Depression, and they grew up actually talking with my parents have passed away, but reflecting on conversations with my parents and conversations with young Indians, they almost remind me of my parents. I mean, my parents were very frugal. They wanted to save money. They wanted to invest in their education. They wanted to make sure when they had children that you know that we got as much education as we possibly could.
Mm-hmm.
Poverty is you know a severe motivator. You know, when I asked one of my engineers, all my engineers over in India and China work 6 days a week. Six-day work week is the norm in China and India. But a lot of them would come in on Sundays, too.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, why do you work so hard? And they said, you know, Mr. Compton, all I have to do is when I come out of my apartment, and this is in India, come out of my apartment and look on the street at the people who are begging and don't have jobs, I don't need any more motivation.
Hmm.
And so that we don't have that as a motivator. We have to find other motivators. And they can, in one generation, from their parents to themselves, dramatically increase their standard of living. And do that with just a job. Here, to dramatically increase your standard of living, you have to have, you know, started a company, built a company, created net worth by creating significant value. It's harder to do it with just a job unless you come from very poor circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have poverty as this organizing focus that, you know, you want to work really hard in school so you can get into the very best college so you can live a better get a job and live a better life style than your parents, and your parents and your community and the society as a whole supports that.
Right.
So it's a very powerful motivator that we've not had to face, you know, for what, 70 years or so.
Mm-hmm. The film also makes a lot of reference to the contrast is so dramatic between the students in Indiana and the students in India and China. You look at this very typical American high school where the two students you've picked who are doing very well, but all the money that's put into the sports field, the new football field, the incredible emphasis on athletics, the amount of hours each week that students spend pursuing athletics instead of academic studies, and the fact that the community is not as supportive. Everybody goes to the football games. They go to the soccer games.
Right.
They don't go to the math competitions.
No, they don't. I screened in Lexington, Kentucky, and a terrific audience and very concerned about their children. And I asked the question. I said, you know, how many of you who don't have a child on the football team go to Friday night football games? And every hand went up.
Oh, my.
And I said, how many of you who don't have a child on the debate club or the math team go to a debate competition or a math competition? And not a single hand went up. It would be the exact opposite in India and China.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everyone turns out for the math competitions, the debate competitions. They even have, in India, they have competitive charades, which I kind of laughed at first, but, you know, that's a nonverbal communication. They're learning. I mean, it's all developing their intellectual and communication skills. And the parents come out, and by attending those events, parents send signals as to what's important to them.
Sure.
When Carmel, Indiana, and my wife grew up in Carmel, Indiana, she went to Carmel High School. It's a great high school. It's in the top 5% academically in America. It's also in the top 5% athletically. But when they spend $30 million to build a football stadium, that speaks volumes to the children about what the adults in that community admire.
Mm-hmm.
And kids aren't stupid. You know, you build an indoor Olympic swimming pool, a $30 million football stadium, and all the parents show up for the athletic events, that's where kids are going to focus.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not to say in India and China. I mean, I just got back from China, and I was amazed. We were going through one of the parks where we were going to one of the competition sites, and there were basketball courts everywhere. There were soccer fields everywhere. There were big areas of ping pong tables everywhere, all packed on a Sunday afternoon with just regular citizens. The Chinese love sports, absolutely love sports, and as their medal count,
exactly,
as their gold medal count is showing, they're actually pretty good at it too. But they don't love them at the expense of intellectual pursuits. I mean, the most important thing in the 2 million minutes that you live in high school is to learn as much as possible academically and to build your intellectual foundation. You still play sports. They, you know, they play soccer and ping pong, and they love basketball. But they don't spend 20 to 30 hours a week practicing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they may spend 3 or 4 hours, and they play it for fun. And if you lose a game, it's not that big a deal. But if you lose a math competition, it's a huge deal.
Right.
Because that reflects poorly on the math teachers, reflects poorly on the school. But, you know, losing a soccer game, nobody really cares.
Mm-hmm. And reflects poorly on your family.
Oh,
right?
Yes. There's a very strong...
Right.
The Confucian tradition and the Hindu tradition, I mean, China and India revere, recognize, and reward academic and intellectual achievement. That is their culture. They have the perfect culture for the 21st century. The American culture reveres and rewards athletic achievement.
Mm-hmm.
We had the perfect culture for the 20th century because we had no big competitors. We've never competed against countries larger than ourselves. Japan is smaller than us. Germany is smaller than us. And so when you're the big dog, you know, you don't have to worry that much. You can do a lot of different things, and athletics were something that we chose to do. I think it's been taken to extremes now. I serve on the board of an orthopedic clinic here in town, and we're seeing 11 and 12 year old boys coming in with, and actually girls, cheerleaders, coming in with knee injuries that we didn't, you know, 15 years ago we didn't see until they were professionals.
Mm-hmm.
And so you know, we've kind of taken sports to the extreme to the detriment of our intellectual pursuits.
Right.
They take intellectual and academics in the minds of many Americans to the extreme. But at the end of the day, it's knowledge that drives an economy, not the ability to shoot a three-point shot.
Right. And yet, I'm wondering, as you met these students and spent time with them, as I watched the film, there was some kind of a sadness about them, that I mean, I love the fact that they were studying so hard and learning physics and learning all of this, but it didn't seem to me as though there was a lot going on, that they were spending all night studying, that they were studying on weekends, that they just didn't have a chance to talk about the meaning of life with their friends or go to a coffee house very often, that it was study, 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 study. I don't know if I could do that.
Well, I think there are a couple ways to think about that, Kathleen. One, culturally, and we just got back from China, and my daughters noticed this as well, because we went out, I arranged for my daughters to go out with some teenage Chinese girls for lunch. Culturally, they're different than us. You know, they are not culturally as gregarious. They're not as loud. They
right.
don't smile as much.
Mm-hmm.
That's just their culture. I mean, there are other cultures. I've traveled all over the world. You probably have too. Just different cultures relate to each other and to other people differently. But I found them to be. We've brought the Indian students over to the U.S. For a couple of weeks to spend time with the two American students. They were, in a social setting, they're every bit as relaxed. And, you know, we took brought the Chinese kids over. We went out bowling.
Hmm.
Now, of course, you know, after we were finished bowling, they brought out their violins and treated us to a concert-level violin concert. And, you know, the Americans didn't play any instruments. I think we need to be careful not to, just walking around China, just walking around Beijing, people are quieter than Americans. Babies aren't crying. There's not a lot of yelling. I mean, there are cultural norms that we might see as, well, they're sad or they're not happy. That's just the way they are.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's important for us not to put our Western values on people in China and India. And when you get with them quietly, one-on-one, in a restaurant, and you talk about they talk about philosophy. They talk about the meaning of life. They're as deep and interesting and humorous as we are. They're just not as loud about it. And so... they're more reticent. They're just, and also both these countries are coming out of, China has been brutalized and occupied and attacked. We were never occupied by the Japanese during World War II. They were, they lived under the dynasties for years. They lived under Mao for decades.
Sure.
That would take a smile off your face. And the Indians. They just celebrated their 60th year of independence. They were colonized by the British for centuries. And so these are young countries and that have had a lot of, they've really been brutalized. And I think that has affected how, no foreign, except back in the 1700s and early 1800s, no foreign soldiers have set foot in our country.
Mm-hmm.
That's not true for them. And so I think they're more reticent. They're also a little less, not little, they're actually a lot less self-confident. I mean, my Chinese software and Indian software developers are brilliant, but they lack self-confidence. But that's going to come. I mean, I'd rather have brilliance and work my way into self-confidence
right.
than have self-confidence and trying to figure out how to be brilliant.
Right. And that's what we have, right?
Oh,
doesn't
we
the film?
Self-confidence
we have self-confidence.
Well, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, and the problem is we haven't had to compete very well. You know, what Japan is doing to Detroit right now, I don't know if you've traveled over to Detroit recently from where you are, but I mean, Detroit, it's like the 1930s. It's a depression.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go down streets there and every home on the street has either a for sale sign or a foreclosure sign on it. Every home. And Japan's a teeny country compared to us, a lot smaller. And so we've not had to compete very, very aggressively. And now the 21st century, our children are going to face not only Indians and Chinese who are now capitalists. And let me tell you, having gone to the silk market with my daughters and bargained for for silks and pearls and I mean, they are, I would say, more capitalist than we are, but also all of the Eastern Europe. and Russia are now in the global economy as competitors, not as military competitors, but as economic competitors.
Right.
So there are, you know, 3 billion people now that our children are going to have to compete against that you and I didn't have to face.
Yeah. Let's take phone calls. Our lines are all filled for Bob Compton. Bob's film is 2 Million Minutes, a Global Examination, which compares and contrasts the high school education experiences of students in India, China, and the United States. And it looks at the 2 Million Minutes is the title because of the amount of time that you have from graduation from eighth grade to graduation from high school. The comparisons are really striking between the Americans and the Chinese and the Indians. And so that's what the film looks at and really challenges the United States to look at the emphasis that we place on sports, to look at what our study is in the United States and why it is that we don't have many students don't go beyond algebra and geometry, that most high school principals are worried about the academic rigor of classes here in the United States. We score higher in self-confidence, but it may be rather meaningless because these young people are developing their brain power, which is giving them a great advantage in the world economy. So I'm sure you'll have a lot to say about all of this. Okay, to your phone calls in a moment. Did I give you the number? 800-486-8655. Milwaukee is 414-227-2050. And our email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Bob Compton, and we start with Tom from Green Bay. Hi, Tom.
Hi. My comment is in relationship to the bell curve of how nations develop as businesses develop, and you're a capitalist society with a consumption society, I think that has an effect on the education process because people become more feel more entitled to things. They feel more the need to consume than an education has a tendency to take a back seat. I think that's what's basically happening in America. Instead of enjoying education and enjoying it like a play toy, like kids play with Tinker Toys, education has looked more as a drudgery in the United States. Hello?
Yeah, we're here. Do you want to respond, Bob?
Yeah, I mean, I think Tom is right. Over in India and China and other developing countries, but particularly those two, the education is not taken for granted. I mean, they're grateful. Just take as an example in China, both in India and China, the way people get into college is very, very different than in the U.S. The college admissions process in India and China is you take an extraordinarily difficult, comprehensive exam across all subjects that ranges anywhere from 6 to 12 hours, depending on the country, and how high you score determines where you get to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
So if you score really high in India, if you score, you know, number one in the country, and they not only do they score highly, but they publish the scores in India on the front page of the newspaper.
Mm.
So it'd be like publishing my SAT scores on the front page of the newspaper, which for me would have been a huge embarrassment. You then get to select. If you're number one, you select any of the colleges in the Indian Institute of Technology network, which is 7 universities, and you get to pick your major, which today 99 out of 100 pick computer science. It's the same way in China. You take a comprehensive exam across all subjects, and the highest score gets to pick Tsinghua or Peking University, the two, you know, Tsinghua, both in Beijing. Tsinghua is the kind of the MIT of China, and Peking is kind of the Harvard of China. You don't write any essays. They don't care whether you played football, or they don't look at anything else. It's sheer academics. So over there, it's very clear how you get into the best universities, and getting into the best universities gets you into the best career, and changes in a generation changes your family's standard of living. Over here, first of all, as I've tried to explain to many of my Indian and Chinese friends, because they, you know, they all, every student worth their salt in India or China are either trying to get into, in India, the Indian Institute of Technology, or in China, Tsinghua or Peking University. And they ask me, and so when I ask them, well, what happens if you don't get into Tsinghua? Well, my fallback schools are MIT, my safety schools are MIT, Carnegie Mellon, Stanford, and Harvard. And they said, but I can't understand the American system. So I get perfects on the SATs. I score, you know, in the top 2% in my country on the national exam. I have straight A's, but I still might not get into Princeton. And I said, well, yeah, because in America, they want to see what you've done outside of school and volunteer work. They want to see what you've done in sports, you know, kind of how well-rounded you are. And that is so puzzling to them. They said, so I could be the smartest person in India, and Princeton might reject me. And I said, yes. And that, they don't understand how American students can figure out what to focus on, because if it's all kind of, to them, that seems very random. And I explained that the universities want to have a balanced, diverse student body to enhance the educational experience. That is so foreign to them, which is really was kind of interesting. But you know, we've been so wealthy. I mean, America is so wealthy and has been so wealthy for so long that you know, our kids just education is just not a priority. Just not with the kids. It's not with the parents. Look at the parents, where we spend our time and money and effort. If your child shows some skill at a sport, you'll hire the best coach, you'll send them to a sports summer camp, you'll travel around the country going to sporting events. I did it. My daughters were year-round swimmers. I mean, they're not now. They swim just for, you know, during the season. I think team sports are very important, as do Indians and Chinese. They play team sports. You know, you can gain lots of valuable skills. You know, learn to be a leader, learn to be a good team player, learn to be a good winner, a good loser. You know, I mean, you learn lots of valuable things in sports. They just don't do it to the extreme. My daughters were in the pool 4 hours a day, 6 days a week, year round. And that's, you know, we just got back from the Olympics, and they had met Michael Phelps at a swim meet, you know, went back when he was 16. That's what it takes, you know, if you want to be a great swimmer in America. So now my daughters play seasonal sports. They play softball, they play golf, they swim. They don't win because they don't train year round, but they play it for the positive things that team sports. In India and China, you know, they put, while my daughters were in the swimming pool, and this is the conversation I had with my daughters when I came back from India, I said, while you're 4 hours in the swimming pool, what do you think they're doing with their 4 hours? Well, they're studying physics, chemistry, biology, and math. And if you add that up over a long period of time, it adds up to a lot of time. They're going to be ahead of you when you get out of college and you start to compete in the global marketplace. Sure. And that's the discussion we had as a family and made a decision, a conscious decision. And at the time, to be candid, not a very popular decision. I mean, swimming is fun. I love going to swimming meets. I love seeing my daughters win. You know, going to mock trial and Model UN, I'll be honest, it's not as exciting. You know, I'm learning to get excited about it because I know they're developing intellectual skills, but going to a swim meet and watching my daughter win was really exciting.
Right.
And so I had to change as an adult, as well as my daughter's changing.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Frank from Madison next. Hello, Frank.
Hello.
Hi.
May I make 2 points to your really fine guest? One is that elsewhere in the world, and especially in India, to have an education means that you're also an intellectual, even if you have a technical background. So if the equivalent of a State Street coffee shop in Bombay, if you sit down, there's someone waiting to have a vigorous discussion with you on topics of the day or even a philosophical point. And this is a recreation. So these people are not they may be working very hard, but they're generally something more than grinds. And ours is not a culture where people who necessarily are intellectuals with an education, they've received a degree. And we've shifted from technical expertise to managerial training. So people who would think are the best and brightest are in business school, and it's people from elsewhere in the world who are in the engineering schools. The second point is that this observation was driven home long ago when Sputnik went up, and the attempt to increase the standards in the American schools was made. New curricula in biology, physics, chemistry, math were developed, but the attempt to introduce them was headed off as perhaps too challenging. So we now have a global challenger, but the perception is not the same as when Sputnik went up. So do you think you have a chance to truly provoke a reform? So thank you.
Thanks, Frank.
Well, I think I think his points are right on target. We are not our culture is not an intellectual culture. And that hasn't hindered us in our lifetimes in the last 50, 60 years because we haven't had competitors, economic competitors, who were who really revel in intellectual development and intellectual growth. And he's right. That's very much Indians and Chinese. They study very hard. They learn a lot. But it's not just math and science. That was a huge misperception I had. I mean, they are, I have to confess, I mean, I was reading a Chinese history book while I was over in China, and I met with several Chinese. I went out to Tsinghua University and met with several faculty there. I mean, they just, as a matter of course, know American history, and they know European history, and they know Indian history, and I knew nothing about Chinese history. I mean, I took world history, I think, in like eighth or ninth grade, but that was the last time. But these were men and women that were my age who they're just more globally aware, and just they pursue knowledge for the sheer joy of learning, and they do love to discuss and debate. I mean, I spent hours talking with a man who had a PhD in Chinese man who had a PhD in philosophy, and I mostly listened because I didn't take, I took one course of philosophy. I was a liberal arts major in college, but I haven't studied it since. And so it's, our culture is really, and that, I believe that is our fundamental problem. It's not our school system. Our school system reflects our culture, just as their school system in India and China reflects their culture. Where do we focus and spend our time? And, I mean, every major city, I live in Memphis, Tennessee, the biggest building, most expensive building in the city is the Grizzlies basketball, the FedEx Forum, the basketball stadium. I go to Indianapolis a lot because I have a number of businesses there. The biggest building going up is a new, they already had a covered dome, but now they needed a really big covered dome with more private suites. I mean, you drive into Indianapolis, the first thing you see on the horizon is the football stadium.
Mm-hmm.
And so, that's our culture is, as adults, that's what we focus on, and our kids follow in our footsteps, and they follow what we find to be important. And that's okay, but it's going to have severe ramifications for our children's standard of living. Just one quick observation. We took these two teenage girls out to lunch one day, and my daughter's 16 going into junior year. The Chinese girl is 16 going into her junior year. they were on summer break, so they have July and August off, and they go a full 10 months. And I said, or my daughter asked her, you know, well, what are you doing for fun, or what are you doing? And she talked about several fun things she was doing. And I said, well, do you do any studying? Yeah, she said, oh, I only do 6 hours a day. You know, I get up at 7 and I study till 1.
Oh, my gosh.
I said, wait a second. Wait, what do you mean? You get up at 7 and study till 1? She said, yeah, I mean, I'm not studying that hard, just kind of reviewing things, making sure I have chemistry, physics, biology, computer science. You know, just I just enjoy it. And then, you know, from 1 o'clock until 8 or 9 o'clock at night, I just goof off. But they were stunned with my daughters, who, you know, my daughters read a lot, and they also still go to a math tutor during the summer, but they don't put in 6 hours a day. They were almost like, well, what would you do with your time? What would you do? What do you do all day?
Right.
And, you know, then my daughters, we had a long discussion after that. What do we do all day?
Right.
Well, we watch TV, and we kind of lay around, and they just don't watch TV and lay around.
Right.
And I'm not saying we have to become like that. You know, a lot of people, when I screen, they say, well, we don't think we should become like Indians and Chinese. I said, that's fine, don't. But understand the ramifications of your decision, because your children are not going to live a standard of living that is equal to the standard of living you're living in their lifetimes, because they will not be competitive. So that's, we can make that decision that we can become, you know, the France of the 21st century. I mean, I've run businesses in France. They do not like to work. That's a cultural decision they've made.
Mm-hmm.
But as a result, you know, their productivity is extraordinarily low. And I ended up closing down the businesses that I ran in France.
Did you really?
Huh. Yeah, because they were so unproductive. Huh. I mean, you know, they come in at 9. At 11, they'd go to lunch for 2 hours. They'd have wine with lunch. They were useless in the afternoon. And I'm sure I get calls from French people, but it's true. I mean, I was there. I'm not making this stuff up. And we can decide to be the French of the 21st century, and we had our time in the 20th century, and the Brits had their time in, you know, in the 19th century. And now it's China and India's turn to be the leaders.
I guess so. More phone calls in a moment. Bob Compton is our guest. He's, he's done all kinds of things in his past 30 years, systems engineer, professional venture capitalist, and investor. And his latest work is to be a filmmaker. The film we're talking about is 2 Million Minutes. Every child will have a chance. It's only a matter of time. A documentary that's calculating the educational divide. He features in the film two students from China, two from India, two from the United States. And it's what he finds is really quite extraordinary. More from you, 800-486-8655. Email address if you'd like, and that's talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, John Zogby, very well-known pollster, will be with us. He has a new book. It's The Way Will Be, the Zogby Report on the Transformation of the American Dream, which sort of ties into what we're talking about today, right? So John Zogby with us tomorrow from the 10 to 11 hour. Robert Compton is here now. 800-486-8655 is the number. 414-227-2050 in Milwaukee. Fritz from Fish Creek is next. Hi, Fritz.
Good morning. I'll echo the person who talked about the intellect and, you know, how we don't appreciate intellect. I think this election will be one that Obama is too intellectual, and you know, he doesn't relate to the people well. I think we've seen that in the past with elections, that, Bush was a guy you could swill a beer with, and look what we got. Okay.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Well, it's interesting, because I think I have screened my film for both Senators McCain and Obama, and had a chance to talk with them both about this, this issue, and... I think probably Obama grasped it a little bit better. I think he's perhaps a little more globally minded, I really don't believe that this problem will be solved out of Washington. I mean, I think if you look over the last 30 years of the solutions and efforts and blue ribbon reports that have come out of Washington, our education system has just gotten worse and worse. Fundamentally, it is a cultural issue, and I have spent now time with a number of governors, but the most receptive has been the governor of Indiana, Governor Mitch Daniels, and what I have been talking with him about, and what he has been starting to implement, is how does he as a leader, and how do the mayors of his states as leaders raise intellectual achievement at least on par with our academic achievement? And because Carmel, Indiana, the school that is in my film, is in Indianapolis, or just outside Indianapolis, the governor came to a screening of my film and called me and asked me to have dinner with him and said, okay, I've never been to India or China, but I understand, I get the point, and we have a serious problem. What do we do, and what does it cost? And what I told him was the good news is it doesn't cost you a whole lot, because what you have to do is not a school problem. You know, taking the whip out and beating principals and teachers and whipping them more is not going to change things. You have to change the culture of your state. And I said, you know, this was in January. I said, in March, you're going to award a Mr. Basketball and a Miss Basketball. And I said, you should also award a Mr. Math.
Yep.
And a Miss Math and a mm-hmm. Mr. Science and a Miss Science.
Mm-hmm.
And to his credit, 2 weeks later, a press release went out calling for nominations of the smartest math and science students, male and female, in the state. And first of all, when he put that press release out, every paper in the state, even the South Bend Tribune, which hates him because they're hardcore Democrat, he's hardcore Republican, they wrote it. He sent me a note with the editorial praising him about raising the intellectual accomplishments of our young people on par with their athletic accomplishments. And then they ended up, I think they had 200 or 300 top students submitted, and then they had a team of scientists, engineers, and teachers select the winners. And oh my gosh, the Mr. Math was amazing. The Miss Science up in Valparaiso, I believe, northern Indiana, was unbelievable. And they got front page coverage
of the
newspaper.
Great
it was
job.
Wonderful. And that's step one, you know. But at least he's making a tiny step. At least he understood.
Right.
And I believe this change has to happen at the state level, the city level, and the community level. And fundamentally, parents have got to say, I love my daughters, or I love my son, and I want them to be economically self-sufficient and economically successful and have a satisfying career. And if I love them the way I profess to, I need to help guide them through their 2 million minutes of high school and help them develop the skills and the capabilities and the knowledge that they will need to lead a productive and satisfying life. And so it's got to, in my view, has to come down ultimately to the family and to the parents and certainly to the community. And the leadership can't come from, we can't keep turning to Washington to solve our problems because they just don't have a good track record.
Mm-hmm.
We have to look at ourselves and in our own communities and in our own schools. And we as parents, I said to the audience in Lexington, I said, I will know that a cultural change has taken place here in Lexington when I go to a Friday night football game and the stands are only half filled,
mm-hmm.
and when I go to a debate team competition and the crowd is packed and cheering.
Mm-hmm.
And until that happens, you're fooling yourselves and you're hurting your children,
mm-hmm.
in my opinion.
And that may take a long time, Bob.
Well, I tell you, we have a couple more Detroits happen, because I'll tell you where the Chinese and Indians are going after next. They are going after the pharmaceutical and medical device industry because it's highly profitable. The FDA is opening 3 offices in China right now. They will start doing clinical trials over there. You know, when Pfizer and Merck and Lilly and, you know, our big pharmaceutical and our big medical device companies In Wisconsin, GE Medical is there. When those companies start getting hammered and laying off thousands of highly educated people because we didn't keep up with the technology and we didn't educate the next generation, unfortunately, that's going to be our Sputnik moment. But that's going to be almost too late because it's really hard. I ran a medical device company, a $400 million spinal orthopedics company. And that's not something you create overnight. It takes years. And I'm afraid Americans, I'm trying to show what's happening right now in the hopes that Americans will wake up and come to their senses and get out ahead of the problem.
Yeah.
But I'm afraid Americans only really rise to the occasion in a crisis.
Mm-hmm. Where do people get the film? We have 4 seconds.
Yes, www.2M2minutes.
Two M minutes. Thank you, Bob, so much. It's definitely worth seeing. It will spark a great deal of discussion. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the program and to Rhonda for on-air production as well. We'll be with you tomorrow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.